This is the New Books in Political Science podcast. My name is Heath Brown. Today I'll be talking to the author of Political Peoplehood, The Roles of Values, Interests, and Identities. The book is published by University of Chicago Press. I hope that you enjoy the interview I did with the author. Welcome back to the podcast. Again, my name is Heath Brown, and I have the real pleasure to talk to Roger Smith today, who is the author of Political Peoplehood, The Roles of Values, Interests, and Identities. My guest today is the Christopher H. Brown Distinguished Professor of Political Science at the University of Pennsylvania. Welcome to the podcast.
Very glad to be here, Heath. Thank you.
Yeah, it was a real pleasure to read the book. It's a reflection of a lot of your writing over the last number of decades. So thank you for coming on to talk about it. Let's start with some real basic stuff here, because your arguments become quite complex as we move along. But let's start with just some basic stuff. So who are the political peoples that you reference in the title of the book and that serve really as the backbone of much of your work here? So who are these political peoples?
Well, political peoples is a term that I've come to use to define an exceptionally wide range of human associations and communities. Political science has looked for a unit of analysis in many kinds of research and during the history of the profession, focusing on individuals or groups or classes. You can understand this as an effort to say that in many ways our fundamental unit of analysis should be political peoples, which are defined as not simply any human association, but as a human association that claims some authority over the allegiances of those it takes to be its members against the claims of other human groups and associations. Any time a group or association or community is claiming authority over people, claiming at least some power to govern them, that makes them a political people in my sense. And a very wide range of human associations, not just nation states, not just cities, but also sometimes political parties, impassioned social movements, environmental advocacy groups, labor associations, a lot of different sorts of human associations do say they have a claim to the allegiance of their members, at least on some topics, as opposed to other groups. And I think that there are some common features to the creation and maintenance of all these forms of political peoples that political scientists should try to understand. There are other kinds of groups that are more purely recreational, aesthetic, kinship groups that don't necessarily claim authority of these sorts. So not everything is a political people, but a wide range of human associations are.
Yeah, so as you just suggest, this is a broad and a fluid concept, but it's not without boundaries. And you lay out four specific premises that constrain this concept. Would you tell us a little bit about the borders that you establish around this very sort of open idea of political peoples?
Well, I argue that there are human communities that and human associations that readily accept that any participation on the part of their members is voluntary, and that they don't have any authority to command the allegiance of their members when, say, a national government or a city government or their religious community, for example, claims authority over their obligations. And that is the fundamental division that I draw. The notion is fluid in this sense, though, that groups which may not be acting as political peoples at one point or in some context may become so in others. You can think of how Protestant religious groups, for example, at some times had been purely voluntary communities of all believers, and at other times, as in the Puritan colonies, they've sought to establish theocracies. Similarly, there are political parties that really represent voluntary consensual interactions among people with a shared political viewpoint, but there have also been political parties, historically totalitarian political parties, that have placed tremendous demands on the allegiance of their members.
Now, storytelling matters a lot to you. What are the kinds of stories that political people tell that matter to their identity, to their values, to their interests that you describe in the title to your book? So tell us about storytelling.
I argue that there are two basic means through which political communities, senses of political peoplehood are formed and maintained. One is through force. If you are conquered by a foreign empire, then you can become a subordinate part of that empire, and that changes your political identity, your political peoplehood. And force, coercion, is always a vital element in creating and sustaining different forms of strong political peoplehood, at least those that claim great authority over their members and impose great demands on them in opposition to other groups. But lots of political scientists study coercion, military power, that sort of force. I have focused in this work on the kinds of stories, narratives, accounts, arguments that political leaders give to help persuade people that they should voluntarily embrace a sense of political membership, because in any reasonably large-scale human community, nobody has enough to compel allegiance through force alone. They need persuasive stories so that they have some voluntary supporters that can form a core constituency that's then can be expanded into a broader form of political peoplehood. And so I've been interested in the content elements of the stories that are the basis for forming and maintaining census of political peoplehood. And at the very general level, I argue that you always need some kind of economic story which promises members that their economic needs will be taken care of. There'll be economic benefits by embracing this form of political peoplehood. You need a political power story that has a couple of components, both a guarantee that your personal physical safety and security will be protected, and ideally you'll have at least some share in the governance of the broader political community or people, at least in the sense that its governors will try to be responsive to your desires, even if it's not formally democracy. They will in some sense represent you. You need those kinds of political power stories, but I've also stressed, and this is a more distinctive element, that you need what I call a constitutive story that indicates that there are things that are valuable about who you are as a person that make it appropriate for you to find this community membership valuable. These are stories that have a normative ethical content suggesting that the things you value normatively can best be realized by embracing membership in this political community. And I argue that these kinds of constitutive stories with their normative components are essential for sustaining political communities over time, because there are always likely to be periods when you're not providing economic benefits or even political power benefits of security and share in broader power very effectively. There are going to be down times, and then you need the sense of allegiance that comes from saying, well, who I am and who I am in the ways that I most value makes it appropriate for me to be part of this political community. And you can hear these kinds of normative constitutive appeals all the time. President Obama, for example, will say over and over again, he's against this policy because that's not who we are as Americans. It's not what we value. Other policies are who we are as Americans. And obviously, if you have a form of political peoplehood that's based on a religious identity, there's this strong sense of your duty as a follower of God is to be loyal to this form of political peoplehood. It's the kind of argument that ISIS uses today, but it's also been used by Christian communities throughout history.
Now, not all of the book is so abstract or theoretical. You make some pretty specific, and I think some would say, you even say, controversial policy proposals based on this idea of coercively constituted identities. So what is this concept, and how does it challenge some of our notions of citizenship, which are so important? They're so important in our in this presidential campaign that we're in the midst of, and you really challenge this in some very particular ways. So maybe you could just explain this idea. This I think for most people would be a new idea.
Yes, it is kind of an abstract argument that issues in some pretty specific policy positions that are sharply opposed to those that Donald Trump is making central to American political discourse right in the moment. At the moment, precisely because I don't think any kinds of political memberships or identities are simply natural. They are all things that are created by human institutions and human practices over time, and yet they are deeply constitutive of our senses of who we are and what we value. I argue that when governing institutions have structured people's lives in ways that have constituted their identities, shaped their senses of who they are, what they value, and what they want to achieve, need to achieve to pursue happiness in life, as the Declaration of Independence promises. When governing institutions have structured people's lives and put the government's coercive power behind that structure of lives, saying this range of family forms is permissible, but that range is not. This range of religions is permissible, but those kinds are not. This kind of education is appropriate, that kind is not. These forms of work are legal, that kind are not. When people have had who they are shaped by the structure of what's permitted and what's not permitted by a particular community, so that their sense of who they are and what they value is bound up with that community, then if that community shares the commitment that the United States has under the Declaration of Independence to promote the pursuit of happiness, then that government has a special obligation to assist those whose identities are what they are, whose aspirations are what they are, in part because the government's policies, its institutions, its coercively enforced practices have helped make them people with those aspirations. And as abstract as I know that sounds, it also means that not only does the U.S. government have obligations to all of us who were born here and grew up here with our senses of identity and aspirations shaped by America's governing institutions and policies, it's also true that those governing institutions and policies have massively shaped people outside our borders, particularly Mexico, which is a country that the U.S., in my view and the view of most historians, chose to go to war with in the Mexican-American War that resulted in moving roughly half of the territory of Mexico to the United States, including Texas, California, Arizona, New Mexico, Nevada, parts of Colorado, all shifted to the United States, extending citizenship to the Mexicans who remained in that territory. And that followed a long period in which the U.S. government often cooperated with the Mexican government in a set of policies that displaced a lot of Mexican farm workers and led them to seek opportunities in the American Southwest. These policies over the course of a century and a half created a community that goes across the border of the American Southwest and Mexico, of people who have found that their economic opportunities, their kinship networks, lead them to have lives that have gone back and across that border, and to have a shared sense of American and Mexican identity. My argument is that that history of the coercively enforced policies shaping the development of the identities and aspirations of lots of this population means that they should have priority over other outsiders that we have not affected, shaped, coerced in those ways in our immigration policies. The easy example is that Mexicans should have some priority in the immigration queue over New Zealanders, whom we've never really affected very much at all. And that does cut against the grain of current U.S. immigration policy. It's also obviously against the desires of lots of Americans who believe that a Mexican immigrant population is undesirable for one reason or another. But I think it's consistent with an understanding of the obligations that the principles of our own government impose on us if we really want to be true to the concern to promote the pursuits of happiness, and particularly the pursuits of happiness of the people we have most shaped and most constituted in ways that make their happiness bound up with being part of the United States.
Yeah, the book was just so very interesting, so novel in these ways that I think you have explained in such interesting ways right now. The book, again, is titled Political Peoplehood, The Role of Values, Interests, and Identities. The book is published by University of Chicago Press and available widely. Professor Smith, thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you so much.